Hello and welcome to the second show of the summer. Today we will be featuring one long interview and a song before that. I hope you enjoy.
That was Stuck in Louisiana, a song written by the band, of which our interviewee is a member, and that song is the first song in their album Won't You Believe Me. The band is The Gated Community, and the album is Won't You Believe Me, It is their most recent album, and they haven't really had much time to perform it because, for obvious reasons, it's been difficult to get performances during the pandemic. And so we thought we'd play it now, because they haven't really been able to play it in public that much. So here, that was Stuck in Louisiana, and now we are going to dive right into our interview, which was recorded about a month ago. Here we are today with Sumanth Gopinath. He is a resident of Minneapolis, and he is a professor of music at the University of Minnesota, and he is in a band with called the Gated Community with I think some of your colleagues at the U.
Yes, that's correct.
Right. Okay. So Nora, do you want us to start us off?
I will start. So you are living in Minneapolis, and where the center of the protests started when George Floyd was killed at the hands of a police officer. So how have those protests progressed since George Floyd's death, and what has changed throughout the time between then?
So this is a great question. I should sort of start by saying that we live just a couple of blocks from the Third Precinct police station that was burned down. And so we were really kind of, you know, surrounded by and in the middle of a lot of the upheaval that sort of followed in the wake of George Floyd's murder. And so all of this feels very intense and personal still. It was a month ago, but we were, both very supportive of the protests. And then, you know, when they turned kind of more violent, we were trying to like figure out how to relate to them. We found out all sorts of strange things. It seemed like outside agitators were at least to some extent involved in exacerbating things. White supremacists, cartel agents, it's really difficult to kind of figure out all of what happened. But the result of which was both like a kind of essentially a significant amount of buildings burned in our area. I mean, the commercial district in my part of town is, you know, a lot significantly reduced to rubble now, which is still like a gut punch every time I see it, because it includes minority owned businesses, people's apartments were there, et cetera. And so, so there's that. I will say that there are incredibly positive changes coming in terms of people really trying to imagine a new future for the city. What could policing look like in the city, with a significantly reduced or, you know, demilitarized police force, abolished police force? And there are all sorts of versions of this out there, but the idea of these kinds of things is exciting and something that people have been talking about for a long time. And it's clear that, you know, tensions have been building around police violence and police murders, you know, both here and across the country. We saw this in Ferguson. We saw this previously here when Philando Castile was killed, another beloved member of the community who, you know, was taken down by a cop. And so this I think this aspect of this is exciting and, you know, scary. I mean, people are fearful of police retaliation over this process. There are legal hurdles, limitations because of the divided politics of the state government. And so all sorts of things are kind of in the air and up in play. And I will say one thing that's happening in relation to all of this is a reconsideration of, you know, issues of racial justice and equity, throughout the sort of broader, you know, societal context in which we live and work. And that extends to music, so that people in the field of music theory, people in conservatories are thinking hard about what it means to, you know, change who is included and in what ways they're included and, you know, whose voices are heard in these contexts, what kinds of music is heard, you know, how to think about decolonizing, schools of music or decolonizing academic inquiry. These things have been around for a long time in terms of people thinking about them, but they've gained a new impetus. And maybe in part, you know, George Floyd himself was a musician. I mean, he was a multi-talented person who, you know, did so many things well and seemed like a great person that I didn't get to know. And the fact that he was himself part of a kind of historically important hip-hop crew in Houston, the Screwed Up Clique, and they sort of developed this chopped and screwed kind of hip hop style that's very influential. That in itself, you know, makes, you know, the impetus for thinking about, you know, the relationship of how to rethink what we do in our field as music scholars and musicians, all that much more vital. So, so it's, you know, there were all sorts of things happening here that are harrowing. I mean, you know, like so many buildings were on fire. People we know who, you know, were telling stories of people getting like run over by groups of white guys and maybe white supremacists. I mean, there are all sorts of like sort of details that are really, you know, I hope someone just documents and writes about, because it feels like nothing I've ever gone through. Yeah, that's maybe a start. Do you have any other specific questions or things you're wondering about in relation to that?
I guess, would you say for the most part, things have, I guess, calmed down in Minneapolis, as it seems they have become increasingly more peaceful across the country? Is that the case in Minneapolis as well?
Yes, it is. I mean, there are protests continuing. I feel like protests are happening every day, and I think that that's great. But yeah, in terms of the sort of the more extreme upheavals, the arsons, the vandalism, burnings, I mean, I think for the most part, as well as the police violence, I mean, the police were brutal to protesters, and they've just, you know, in the last sort of, you know, few years, and particularly as of late, have just become completely, you know, unhinged with using tear gas and rubber bullets on people. I mean, these were things that were, you know, much, you know, they were limited in terms of like what kind of crowd control work they were supposed to do. Tear gas is, you know, banned by the Geneva Convention. I mean, there are all sorts of things that are terrible about what they're doing, and just seems like the response of the police has only further exacerbated things in certain ways. But yes, things are calming down here, and I think that that's, you know, I think that that's good. I mean, I was concerned about just people getting hurt and, you know, and worse. I'm also concerned about the pandemic. It hasn't gone away. And what we're now seeing is, you know, not actually a response. It seems like the protests actually didn't seem to largely generate the kind of spike in infections. Mm-hmm. But now what is happening is just people are, especially, I should say younger adults, are kind of going out without masks, and the infections are just starting to spike. So, I mean, that's a whole other element of all of this, is the way the pandemic influenced and related to this, which is an important part of the story too.
Yep. Okay, so I guess now moving on to our main topic that we wanted to discuss with you. As I've said in the beginning, you are a professor of music, and I thought that it would be interesting, and I think we all thought that it would be interesting for us to discuss a little bit about different composers who are all kind of really hailed as great composers right now. Like we all think of them as some of the greatest composers. But I guess how they were accepted in their time is an interesting thing that I haven't heard that much about. And I think we would be interested to find out. And so we've had a bit of back and forth before this interview. And so I guess we should start off several hundred years ago with Felix Mendelssohn. If you want to talk a bit about that, and then we can progress.
Sure. I was going to just offer a couple of general thoughts maybe first, and then we'll get into Mendelssohn, because he's a really important case to think about. And it does tie into what we were talking about earlier. The story of reception of composers is really one of a kind of ongoing project. What does it mean to engage with the past and to, you know, reevaluate what one thinks about musics and, you know, composers, creators of the past, to be able to kind of, you know, make them relevant for the current, you know, age. And that's a project that is sort of ongoing and very much a historical process. I think one of the things that we find in our current moment, which is a very important development and certainly not, you know, unprecedented by any means, but I think very much sharply accented in the current moment, is the emphasis on both a kind of creator's individual biography and their identity and background. You know, are they people of color, or are they women, or women identified? Are they, you know, Were they marginalized individuals in some way? Or alternately, what was the ethics of these particular composers and creators? Were they, you know, sort of known to be racists or particularly like violent, problematic, disturbing people? All of these things that, you know, are part of the evaluation of culture in popular culture today. These are central questions, right? We hear these discussions about someone like, you know, R. Kelly or Michael Jackson or what have you, right? These are sort of formally lionized and, you know, for their, what they do, really important musicians who turn out to be, you know, really disturbing and, you know, whatever, sociopaths, whatever you want to call them, right? I mean, they're, you know, undertaking criminal behavior, doing terrible things. And so this kind of reckoning with the past on the basis, I would say, of identity and ethics is central to our moment. And so it's, I would say that that's not the only way to evaluate music, of course, or, you know, cultural production. And it's interesting to see what other people have talked about and then maybe to intersect that question or how other people have talked about it with bringing things back to the question of identity. And I'm particularly interested because of the history of classical music's centrality in Europe. You know, the European sort of racial politics has long centered around politics of anti-Semitism and racism against Jews. And so this is a really interesting question in American and, you know, European classical music and has been for a long time. And so so this is another thing that sort of is worth folding into the mix, I think. So what I wanted to start with in relation to all this is to say that I was inspired recently by reading an essay by Charles Rosen called The Irrelevance of Serious Music. And it's an essay that came from some of his journalism. So Rosen was a really important musicologist, music critic, and a concert pianist. I mean, an incredibly talented person. He also wrote about literature. I mean, he was one of these incredibly erudite human beings, you know, just wrote about a lot of things, knew about a lot of things. And his catalog of publications is extensive, and his catalog of recordings is pretty extensive. So a very remarkable person. A difficult, you know, person, I will say, not someone that endeared himself to a lot of people. But Rosen wrote a very interesting piece, this piece that I'm talking about, in this book called Critical Entertainments, which it stemmed from earlier sort of journalistic pieces, which then turned into an essay. And the basic thrust of the argument is that it sort of critiques the idea that we should evaluate music based on its popularity, and that popularity is a sort of determinant of artistic merit. He's sort of basically like says that this is a product of concert culture and the fact that the public concert, which, you know, really emerged as the kind of primary vehicle for the evaluation of and engagement with music in Europe in the 19th century, and then of course it you know, appears in other parts of the world, including the United States. This is a, for that, you know, so the European concert tradition, this is something that, you know, he says is actually a relatively short span of time. Like in other points of time, you would have small coteries of people and there was patronage from the church or from the, you know, sort of the royalty, the aristocracy, to kind of cultivate, you know, cultures and production around, you know, the work being done in those specific spaces. So Rosen emphasizes, and I think he gets this because he himself was such a good and, you know, professional performer. He says that if there are performers who are excited about a particular composer, they will really carry that forward regardless of how popular the music is. And he sort of makes the case essentially for small groups of really enthusiastic people and performers being at the core of how composers in the concert tradition came to be evaluated with great esteem later. And he makes the case that in large part, it isn't that we today evaluate and value the composers who were the most popular in their day. We actually tend to value composers who were seen as strange and difficult, and that provided a kind of challenge to real enthusiasts to get into and then become enthusiasts for this music and advocate for it. And it's that kind of trajectory that ends up kind of making the lasting sort of, you know, sort of effects on, you know, what is valued. That's his argument. Yeah, you have a question.
Oh, I was just going to say, do you think Mozart with, I don't know, more of his very conventional style as opposed to as many Beethoven or those who came after him, or really a lot of other composers. You were talking about how people are attracted to something different, something strange. Do you think Mozart's an exception to this or not?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, Mozart in his day was also seen as strange and difficult, too learned, too weird. There are too many changes. Like, it was hyper fast in terms of how many textural and cult, you know, sort of musical sort of shifts his music exemplified. So Mozart is very much like, and Haydn was seen that way too. Now, these composers, to varying degrees, you know, had moments of popularity. Mozart had certain moments, you know, the earlier phases of his sort of mature piano concertos had a great deal of popularity. Certain operas had popularity, but it wasn't sustained. And Mozart was certainly not the most popular composer of his day. He was someone who struggled on the market. He was someone who really kind of emerged in a period in which composers were sort of being less likely to be supported by, you know, sort of the church or state, and instead sort of trying their hand out in the market. And one can see Mozart as a kind of failure in that way. He didn't really quite get the kind of market success that he hoped to, and that later composers like Beethoven, for example, had greater success in this regard, although Beethoven also had a great deal of aristocratic patronage, you know, for a long time. But both Mozart and Beethoven, and then Haydn, who had patronage his whole life. I mean, that was a very different situation. So very much of an earlier formation. Esterhazy's court, you know, supports him, right? I mean, and you know, there are all sorts of complex conflicts with that employment arrangement, but one that gave him a base from which he, you know, sort of developed his originality and ended up becoming, you know, seen as one of the greatest composers of his day. But Haydn, but again, like even with Haydn, was also seen as bizarre and strange and unusual. And it took time for people to get used to this music. And it was really the generation after the so-called first Viennese school of composers of these three had passed on. So, you know, after, 1827, right? That's Beethoven's death year, that you get this kind of reckoning and reassessment of this tradition and this heritage, and then people start to see them as great. These are the great composers that we need to kind of hew to. And it's, you know, and Schubert is basically, you know, a young person who dies only a year after Beethoven, sort of already of a later generation, but someone who's very sensitive to and learning so much from Beethoven, and is kind of a model in certain ways for what later composers in the 19th century and you know, I'm talking about the Germanic and German language world would do. So yes, I would say Mozart is very much of that same story. You know, you could say the same for Schubert. It took a long time for Schubert to be, I mean, Schubert was appreciated in steps. He certainly wasn't appreciated widely in his day. I mean, he died very young, so he didn't live very long, 31, but he was sort of like, you know, seen as a genius in his circle of admirers and people who supported his music, and his, you know, sort of was a kind of political circle. People have come to sort of see it as a circle significantly made up of what we would think of today as gay men. At that time, it wasn't conceptualized in that way, but there are all sorts of interesting identity factors. And I will say that Schubert's star has risen in the contemporary moment, precisely in part because of this. I mean, Schubert's music is extraordinary, but people are also open to it because the sort of model of Beethoven as the sort of single model for what great music is has been somewhat displaced, and identity played a role in that. So anyway, a lot of the people we tend to value today, I mean, there are certainly exceptions, but tend to be seen as difficult and weird in their day.
So I guess getting back to, you talked a little bit about, I think, the topic of anti-Semitism and stuff like that. So I guess going back to Mendelssohn and his reception, I guess, and his legacy throughout the centuries what about that?
That's a great question. So Mendelssohn is an interesting case because he was very popular in his day. He was seen as kind of, and you know, his popularity, and we should say, you know, Mozart's popularity ebbs and flows in different ways, right? Partly because he starts off as a child prodigy. So among the aristocratic court circles, he's kind of seen as this, you know, boy wonder, right? Which that attracts a certain kind of spectacle value. Then as he ages and starts to kind of make his way in the market, that's when he starts facing more difficulties. And, you know, there's also this kind of struggle between him and his father. That's sort of part of the story too. So there's all sorts of stuff going on with Mozart. But Mendelssohn is of a later generation, you know, born in 1809. So already, you know, quite a bit later, you know, half a century, you know, after Mozart. And if we think of Mendelssohn's particular situation, he is another, you know, case first of seeing as an incredible boy genius. He is, you know, in some ways, his early music is more remarkable than Mozart's for his age, because it's not only demonstrating this incredible, you know, sort of talent and skill and musicality, you know, sort of unerring, you know, sort of quality, but also intellectual depth in a way that Mozart took more time to develop. And that's partly because of the family he was a part of. He's a part of a family of assimilated Jews. And this is an intellectual family. His grandfather was Moses Mendelssohn, who's a very important Jewish philosopher who kind of is like one of the key central figures in the German Enlightenment and sort of making the case for the secularization of Jewish life and you know, making the case for you know, full inclusion, political inclusion of Jews in, you know, Prussian and German sort of language world life. So Moses Mendelssohn is a key figure in all of this, and his grandson was, you know, his grandson really valued him, and as his Mendelssohn grew up as assimilated, so his parents, I think, baptized them and they took the name Bartholdy. So you'll see sometimes the name Felix Mendelssohn Bartholdy, which is that's the Christian, you know, given name. But Mendelssohn rejected it and only wanted to be called Mendelssohn, which is also really interesting. I mean, I think he saw himself not only in that vein, he and his sister sort of discussed often not liking the name Bartholdy, apparently. Anyway, all of which is to say that Mendelssohn then, because of the intellectual depth, the kind of precociousness, and a lot of like sort of information that he has, you know, he's being taught by really brilliant teachers. He's, you know, he meets Goethe early on. I mean, he meets like the great intellectuals of his time. He ends up basically, you know, sort of forming this incredible early oeuvre of work. And then he's also celebrated as a pianist and a conductor and as an institution builder. And then he's, you know, sort of at these, you know, festivals conducting. He's you know, incredibly popular. And then he dies in 1847. He dies. And so the long history of Mendelssohn is basically one of an increasing development of anti-Semitism in the German-speaking world that comes to evaluate him as a kind of, you know, like flashy and like a kind of imitator, which is one of the sort of criticisms that you'll get from sort of racist ideology, right? That like the non-pure race can only best like sort of mimic the sort of master race, right? And so this kind of thinking it starts out as a linguistic thing. In Wagner, it isn't actually sort of racial as much as it is linguistic and cultural. Increasingly over the development of the 19th century and the early 20th century becomes biological and racial. And then, of course, this culminates in the Nazi period. And it's in that period that Mendelssohn's music is banned. There are systematic attempts to write him out of history. And then basically, as a result of this, he ends up, his reputation suffers. And one could say it has never entirely come back. But the project of post-war era was to, in many ways, to rehabilitate his reputation and to think about it and to reimagine it anew. Okay. So Mendelssohn is story is really, you know, important because he is not an example that, like Rosen talks about. I mean, he was clearly seen as an intellectual and someone writing challenging and interesting music. He wasn't like a kind of fluff composer, but he was someone who was popular in his day. And that makes him in some ways a very different kind of figure than some of the ones we've been talking about. Not these like cranky weird Beethoven and obscure Schubert and academic Brahms, you know, misunderstood grandiose Mahler, you know, like, you know, the super misunderstood and seemingly polemical Schoenberg, right? I mean, there's so many composers who, again, we value today, but at the time they were controversial. Now with Mendelssohn, part of the story is because he was very interested in cultivating a kind of history of music and cultivating what we call today the canon, or this kind of, you know, pantheon of great composers who are part of whom is esteemed and who should be sort of, you know, maintained as a kind of cultural treasure that is then passed down through the ages to people in the future to learn about. Well, Mendelssohn is a key architect of this very idea. He is someone who, because he valued cultural assimilation, cultural knowledge as part of a project of inclusion in as a citizen within the kind of emerging Prussian, you know, sort of in the Prussian state and emerging German, you know, nation. It wouldn't be there till later, but it, so the ideas of this are sort of, you know, developing over time. This is something that Mendelssohn really was sensitive to. And so one of the most famous things he did wasn't any of his compositions, but his revival of the St. Matthew Passion by Bach, which he revived what he thought was 100 years later after its first performance in 1829. It turns out to have been first performed in 1724, but it was performed in 1729. Anyway, all of which is to say that Mendelssohn's sort of you know, meticulous interest in historical you know, documents. I mean, he did careful score study and manuscript study to try to kind of like capture this historical information. You know, he didn't want to add extra parts, you know, no adding tubas, no adding, you know, like, which was very common in the 19th century to start filling out stuff based on the resources you had to make the sound of the music grander or bigger. He was very resistant to that. So in that way, a kind of classicist, maybe in some ways kind of, you know, foreshadowing the period practice movement today. So anyway, for all these reasons, he sort of helped to establish Bach's legacy as one of the great composers. And, you know, there are people who have been trying to do it before, but Mendelssohn plays a key role in that.
So on that topic of kind of anti-Semitism that you were talking about with Mendelssohn and we were discussing a little bit in our email exchange beforehand about someone else you thought would be interesting to talk about reception-wise, and going off that theme about how Mendelssohn was kind of regarded as not quite the real deal in composing because he was Jewish, and so what about someone who's more contemporary, much more? I think what, born in like the 1930s, I think.
Yep, that's right.
Steve Reich. What about him? Do you think how does he play into this theme kind of?
Well, in a lot of ways, and maybe I'll frame the discussion of Reich around a number of, like, a broader trend that I want to kind of lay out, and then I'll talk a bit about Reich in relation to it. So the story we were discussing, the kind of, to recap what we were talking about earlier, there's sort of this model of, you know, canon formation created in part by people who take up the mantle of composers or musicians who are seen as difficult or strange or making something very challenging or unusual, and then later kind of, you know, spreading it to the public and bringing more people into the idea of being into this music. And Mendelssohn is an interesting case because his music largely wasn't seen that way, but he did that with other composers. He did that with Bach, especially, as well as Beethoven. I mean, he was a conductor and performed, you know, great pianist, so he performed all sorts of music. And again, like this kind of dichotomy is oversimplistic, right? I mean, Beethoven certainly had concert successes, as did Mozart, as, you know, Schubert didn't really, but a lot of composers, it's more like they were sort of seen as, it wasn't like a universal, oh, they're just popular and great, like everyone loves them, the way that, like, you know, basically everyone loved Michael Jackson or something, you know, in the early 80s. It wasn't like that. I mean, there was controversy around them. It was too hard, too challenging, or too weird. Certainly late Beethoven fits that bill. Going back to Mendelssohn, what's really interesting about him is that, just as you were saying, Rafi, that he was sort of maligned for being Jewish, and this sort of anti-Semitic criticism sort of emerged over the course of in the years following his death, really in the second half of the 19th century into the 20th century, and really kind of culminating with the years of the Third Reich. But one thing that's really important in this story is that because of the history of Jewish assimilation in Europe, you know, which is a sort of development that really kind of gained steam in part due to people like Moses Mendelssohn, really is a recent phenomenon. And as it turns out, there's a kind of stereotype today of musicians being Jewish, or that a lot of great musicians are Jewish. This has been true historically in the United States in the 20th century, continues to be true today, but this wasn't always the case. This is also a historical phenomenon and a product of this assimilation story that that took, you know, figures like Mendelssohn, critics, performers like Yosef Joachim, Ferdinand David, critics like Adolf Bernhard Marx, to kind of create these spaces and cultures in which Jewish participants in the world of, you know, classical music, and we should distinguish this from, you know, Jewish liturgical music and traditional musics, which of course, you know, have, you know, many centuries, millennia of tradition behind them. But this idea of Jews in classical music is relatively recent. And so this is an important story because part of the anti-Semitic reaction is a reaction to a relatively new phenomenon. And by the time you get to the 20th century, the acceleration of involvement of Jewish musicians in the life of European and then American classical music becomes like so much more common. And it's really interesting, I think, to take sort of step back and think about, if you think about the great composers in, you know, the sort of canonic imagination of the 19th century, and then you compare them to the great composers in the canonic imagination of the 20th century, the number of Jews in the second half goes way up. In the first half, you have Mendelssohn, who's really like kind of the greatest one. Al-Khan is a figure who's a piano virtuoso of his time, celebrated, certainly really interesting composer, but only recently has kind of become to be taken up. Another figure is Meyerbeer, who at the time was incredibly popular as an opera composer, but his music has, you know, largely fallen out of favor. I mean, people are starting to kind of revisit it and bring it back into the light, which is a good thing. But Meyerbeer has not stood the test of time in the same way that Mendelssohn did. Offenbach is another important figure, another really interesting one. But it's really this 20th century development and figures like Mahler, Zemlinsky, Schoenberg. I mean, these are like some of the most important figures of Viennese music of the early 20th century and late 19th century are revolutionizing what music is. And that is that sets a kind of trajectory and train that really has not abated to this day. If you think about, I was just like writing down a list of like famous composers. If you think of Kurt Weill would be another really important one. But in the second half of the century, the numbers just go way up among European composers. Some of the greatest ones, George Ligeti, George Kurtag, both Hungarian Jews, Kagel, Mirzio Kagel, Argentine German Jew, Schnitka, Russian Jew. They were like, those four composers are four of the greatest composers in the, you know, history of post-war art music. And then when you look at the American composers, because for various reasons, economic and racial discriminatory, many Jews made their way to the United States. The proportion of Jewish composers and songwriters is so high. And think of the names like George Gershwin, Aaron Copland, Leonard Bernstein, Morton Feldman, Milton Babbitt, Steve Reich, Philip Glass. I mean, the names just go on and on. Irving Berlin, Sondheim. I mean, So it's really remarkable, right? And so I think what is important to appreciate is the recency of this development. Not that Jews haven't been making music, because music is a human thing, right? Every culture has its music and people make, you know, amazing music. But this relationship to this classical music thing, this European classical tradition, that's a newer thing. And I think that's really important in the development of, what classical music came to be, and the way that key figures like Mahler and Schoenberg also really set a kind of imaginary for what is experimental, what is the future of music, how to imagine a music that could be, you know, radical and transformative and change your perception and change your life. I mean, these are, in both of their ways, Mahler and Schoenberg were committed, so committed to the idea of music as this profoundly transformational life or death thing. And that's a remarkable thing in and of itself. So Steve Reich is someone who benefits from this, you know, history. I mean, we think of Steve Reich because he's associated with the institute, the sort of movement called musical minimalism, as someone who's an outsider, or was an outsider who then sort of made his way in. But the truth is, he's someone of a relatively privileged economic background, son of a lawyer, grew up in the New York area. And went to conservatory. Well, first he went to undergrad as a philosophy and music major. Steve Reich is a very smart man, and part of why he's influential and isn't part because his writings on music are also so really interesting and thoughtful. So people, you know, take not only his music seriously, which is wonderful music, but also his writings, which are really remarkable. Anyway, Reich starts off in philosophy and music, wants to become a composer. He's a jazz drummer as a kid, took percussion lessons, with, I think, the New York Philharmonic timpanist Roland Koloff, if I remember correctly. And then once he graduates from Cornell, he decides to take composition lessons, and then ends up going to Juilliard to get a master's in music or study there, and then ends up going to California because he wants to get away from the New York area, and he wants to study with, new figures of composition. And out there, Luciano Berio, the Italian composer, was teaching, and so Reich went to go study with him. This is a really interesting development because, you know, Reich is someone who, in his connection to San Francisco and the Bay Area, and after graduating there, he stays there and basically gets involved in the counterculture. And so he's there kind of working with experimental theater musicians, including Ronnie Davis of the San Francisco Mime Troupe. That's a really important theater group there he starts doing music for. And it's really out of that sort of countercultural crucible that his most innovative and experimental music emerges. And then it's through that his reputation develops. He moves back to New York, continues on the sort of train of development that it started in San Francisco. And then, you know, his career continues to just progress and develop. And for maybe a decade and a half, from the mid 60s through the end of the 70s, he's seen as a kind of outsider experimental musician with a gaining reputation. And by the time he gets to the 80s, he's starting to get commissions from orchestras. He's starting to be seen as one of the established figures of composition. And now to this day, people think of him as the greatest living American composer. Now that Charles Warren died, he's certainly one of the contenders for that title even more now. So it's a success story. Someone who started out not being so successful or seen as successful, and kind of through, you know, persistence and through transformations in his own music, I would say, as well as gaining familiarity with it, gained success. So Steve Reich is, I think, characteristic of a lot of the composers of this minimalist tendency who really kind of emerge out of the counterculture. Philip Glass, Steve Reich, John Adams, Terry Riley, Lamont Young, and to varying degrees of success, kind of, you know, gained a foothold in, you know, broader musical culture and got taken up as sort of heroes. And, you know, I mean, they all, their success varies quite a bit between them. I mean, but all of them are, you know, sort of valued and established in some way.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for talking with us. I learned a lot. I think, I think we all did. So thank you so much. That was very interesting.
Great. Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you.
So we are now going to transition over to the music segment. And our first song is a song from someone who we discussed a lot during this interview, Mendelssohn. And this song was suggested to us actually by Sumanth after the interview. And this is his overture to Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. And this was written when Mendelssohn was just 17. So very early in his career, his short career. And this piece, as an overture, was written as a standalone piece, and then he did write music to accompany a play, production of Midsummer Night's Dream, but that was 16 years later, so this piece was originally written to be performed on its own. So here is Mendelssohn's overture to A Midsummer Night's Dream. Thank you. So now we are going to play another song written by Sumant's band in their album Won't You Believe Me. And this one is called Silver Dagger.
Oh, Silver Dagger.
So this will be our last song of the evening, and it is it was written by Steve Reich and suggested to us, another one suggested by Sumanth, and this is a Steve Reich classic. It's music for 18 musicians, and just to give you a sense of the instruments that you'll be hearing in this ensemble of 18, there's several voices, violin, cello, several marimba and xylophones, some maracas, two clarinets, and a few pianos. And so, here we go. Music for 18 Musicians by Steve Reich.